Sabrina George, part two, interviewing John Antropus on a cafe in King's Road. In a cafe on King's Road. So you and Johnny hit it off straight.
Yeah, marvellously. We were drinking companions. We would debate politics. It was it was great with Ray and Alan, and I met Spike as well. Spike was more. He could be left wing, but he could be sort of vaguely fascist. You never knew. But Eric Sykes was definitely your conservative right wing. So we'd have all the over merry drinks. Long into the lunch. Long lunchtime. But most of them would go back to work after lunch, and I would want to go on drinking. And Johnny would often join me, and we'd go off up to Soho. And it was sort of great in a way, but it's just how life was.
So were you like all meeting in an office and sitting across the table from each other, theoretically?
We started in Shepherd's Bush for a little while, and then we moved up to High Street, Kent, and John and I used to drink in the Goat, just local. It's still there, the Goat Tavern. Oh, God. Of course, early on I met Spike, and I heard some coming from upstairs. That was Spike. I think he was with Larry Stevens. And I hit it off with Spike because we both had sort of military background, really. He had a military background of having been shelled in Italy. My military background, we both had military sort of sergeant major fathers, and I had been bombed in Exeter. So
the farting grandmother, which he must have appreciated enormously.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. So
when you were with, just to go back to the beginning with Johnny, did you like literally sit at a typewriter opposite each other and spark off ideas?
Yeah.
How did you get going on a script?
What we'd do, we'd have to get the script in by, say, Friday morning, something like that.
Half an hour?
Yeah. We'd have to get it in a half-hour script every week.
Dialogue, yeah.
So, for recording on the Sunday. So, we'd meet on the Monday, and no hurry, talk over ideas, have a drink, go for a drink. The Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, still nobody's started much. Friday night, up all night, deliver the script. Thursday night, up all night, deliver the script on Friday morning.
And exactly how did the script go? Did you just go, right, we're going to open with this line, and then he'd follow with another line? How did you...
We just bounce it around.
Right.
Sometimes he'd write it, and sometimes we just bounce it around. I'm not denigrating the roles that Dick Barry and Terry Nation play, but I know we were such egoists, John and I, that we sort of did swamp. I can only sort of remember. And particularly as we seemed to come alive at about 2 o'clock in the morning or so, or start at 11 and just press on till about 3 or whatever, and just do it. Occasionally we might finish a day, sometimes a day early, and sometimes it would be the responsibility of one of us to go around and take the script round to Frankie Howard, which was an adventure. And Johnny relates that once he took the script round, and got in, and Frankie was in the bath. He said, "John, can you come and tell me about the script?" And he's in the bath, and he said to John, "Can you put your hand in the water and tell me if it's too hot?" He's already well immersed. And Frank had a few times when he chased me around the piano, but it came to naught.
He had a bit of a reputation,
yeah,
didn't he?
But he was a great guy. For instance, we had a bomb happy producer. I call him bomb happy because called Alistair Scott Johnson. He was an ex officer, army officer, and they seemed to send army officers to BBC Comedy who were otherwise unemployable, and their idea was to run, the BBC Aeolian Hall rather like an army unit, exactly. So, and I know one, and I by then always looking for an identity, which I've pretty well given up on now. I just let it, whatever it happens, whatever turns me on on the day. But then it was James Dean, so I had my jeans and my leather jacket, and we used to
and your hair,
yeah, it's great, real cream. I got some photographs of it.
Gorgeous.
I could have used these. Use it while you got it. So we'd go on and take a bow at the end of this show, the writers, and those just popped on. Now I introduced you to the writers, and he came up to me after the show once and said, next week, he said, put on a suit and get your hair cut. I won't let you come on the stage to take the bow. And Frank got to hear of it, and he tore into him. He said, how dare you? He said, whatever he said about the way he was, your urine encrusted trousers or whatever, and your tatty jacket. I made up the urine encrusted trousers, right? I'm a writer, you see, and
embellish.
I like to embellish. Or you get nothing. My book called Surviving Spike Milligan is a case in point. I've had to imagine some of the scenes in that book. It was going forward to the 70s. Becoming a famous scriptwriter, they started doing comedy playhouses. Gorton and Simpson did the first. It was for them. It was conceived by Tom Sloan. And then they decided to do comedy playhouses. This is for television.
This is for television.
Yeah.
This is like an hour-long show.
Half an hour. Yeah. So they said, we'll do it. Open it out to other writers. And they commissioned one for me. And I wrote a script called An Apple a Day. And they turned it down. So a couple of years later, I showed it to Peter Sellers, who was mad for it. So Peter says, I'll do it. So they, sloppy BBC, they had to pay for it all over again, right from the word go, much bigger fee. And right at the last minute, which is not unusual for Peter, he dropped out, just was not available. So they got Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, which equals one Peter Sellers to them. So anyway, that show was done. And Spike Milligan was in the play, and Ken Griffiths. So you can imagine, I go along to the first day of rehearsal with Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Spike Milligan, Ken Griffiths, and my God, what was it like? Tell me.
I can't remember a thing.
So I made up. I could say, from the depths of my soul came the memory tapes. But it was. And anyway, I made up this fantastic dialogue between them all. And I've had people come up to me and say, what a privilege it must have been for you to listen to the wit of these geniuses. And I wanted to shout out, and now I'm confessing. I wrote that. You know, but I didn't. This is the first time, podcast listeners, that the confession is made, and it was me. And it's a lovely. And anyway, I don't know. The book's out of print now, but I'll get it back in print and take it from there.
When was the time that you were doing the Frankie Howard, Johnny Spacey at the end of the 50s?
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of people starting to come through that were just extraordinary.
Yeah.
Did you sort of feel that, or did you just expect that was the way the world was going to be?
No, I was so egotistical and so wrapped up, just so wrapped up in myself. I'm still dreaming. I didn't have this awareness of that sort of comedy talent. The other thing was that I was determined to be a playwright by then. And at the time of Look Back in Anger, I thought, I want to write a play for the Royal Court. I want to be a Royal Court writer. So immediately...
Theatre, by the way. Very alternative at that point.
Yeah, well, the English Stage Company, the English Stage Company with George Devine, the founder of it. That was my aim. And so as soon as I finished the Frankie Howard radio series, I took the royalty, and I was being paid royalties on repeats, which is 13 guineas a week, which is absolutely enough to go to St Ives in Cornwall and live well and write my play.
Lovely things.
Yeah. So I took off to Cornwall, and I know when I was down there, Spike phoned me up and said, come back and work with me on the Goon Show. I'll pay you £100 a week, which was a lot of money at the end of the day. Towards the end of the 50s, but I wouldn't, because I wanted to be now a famous playwright. So,
does that I think it's Bruce Forsyth said that comedy is like golf. You can always beat your own personal best, and that's what you're always trying to do. And to me, it sounds like you didn't even have to try that hard. It just sort of kept rolling along. Job offers, people coming to do things.
That's right.
What happened with rejection?
Sorry?
What happened to you with rejection? If someone rejected the script or they didn't like it?
Well, then they were idiots.
Right.
Yeah. So, and in those glory days of Associated London Scripts, it was great. We had such a high opinion of ourselves and of our work, and there weren't all these committees and audience measuring surveys going on. The sort of writing that we loved was Ibsen and Chekhov, and we talk about all these because we love Stephen Leacock as well, American comic writer. But we fed off this sort of comedy, and so we would dare people to at the BBC, how dare you alter this? How dare you change this line? You know, we are the writers. And now, of course, they quote all sorts of things like PC or audience appreciation or this or that, or their own miserable ideas that they can write. But then, it was great to be a writer. It was great to be a writer in comedy in those days.
And did you always write with either one other person or a group? You never wrote on your own?
I wrote with Spike.
So it was always with another person?
Not when I'm writing a play, when I was writing my plays. But I didn't write with Johnny apart from the early days. But I wrote with Spike. And that was brilliant. In the times we were together. It's no good having regrets, but I would have, in one way, liked to have cherished that relationship more. Because you don't realise how good things are. And you don't realise, I didn't realise that I had this gift for comedy, and that it was a gift to share with the world. I was always looking to, look to do something else than to be a playwright. But it's wonderful to be a comedy writer. It's wonderful to.
Why do you think the relationship with Spike was so special? What was it about?
Well, because it was filled with such laughter and such sort of unspoken in a way mutual respect. It was a great rapport. Norma Farnes, his agent, in the later days anyway, they said, no one John's in, because you can hear the howls of laughter coming from upstairs. So it was just such a joy to write. It was just crazy, it was beautiful stuff. Yeah.
So then what happened to the play that you wrote in St Ives?
Well, I wrote several, but somewhere along the line, I came back and wrote to London now and again
and did things.
I started writing a play called The Bed Sitting Room, which is about a guy who turns into a bed sitting room. And I told it to the Royal Court, and I don't know if they gave me a commission, but I told it to Bernard Miles, and he commissioned it. I told it to Spike, and Spike was going around doing his impression of the story, which all took place now after a nuclear attack, and Lord Fortnum of Alamein was mutating into a bed sitting room. So then a group came to Spike in what must have been the early 1960s or something like that, called Tomorrow's Audience, and
it's like a theatre group.
Alternative theatre group that had Willie Rushton was in it, and so they wanted a play for the Marlowe Theatre, Canterbury, a one-act play. And Spike said, "I'll ask John if we can write up this." And I've been writing my version very slowly in a way. And so I said, "All right, Spike." So we knocked it out, and we set, and we gave it to tomorrow's audience, and it was done as half of a double bill. And it was not, then what happened was Kenneth Tynan said, famous Observer theatre critic, said he was going down to review it, and Spike sent him a telegram saying it's not finished, it's work in progress, please don't go. But Kenneth Tynan went, and he gave it the whole of the, gave it a rave review. And the next morning, Vernon Miles is on my doorstep doing his Pimlico, waving a contract saying the play is mine. Can you write it up to full length? I'll put it on in following January.
And where would that have been?
The Mermaid Theatre.
Oh, right.
The Mermaid Theatre down at Blackfriars. This was a beautiful theatre in those days, a converted warehouse, as was I. As was Lord Fortnum of Alamein. Yes, he turned into a warehouse. We had to write some extra scenes for it, and I went, Spike at that Christmas was appearing as Ben Gunn, so I wrote these scenes with Ben Gunn, because he was never in out of his costume. And that was brilliant. And so in January, it was during the snow, I think it was 62-63, a very cold winter, we opened to rave reviews and a full house at the Mermaid. I'm vindicated as a playwright, writer, and I directed it, because Spike said, we will direct it. What he said was, we're not going to have some poof come along and direct it, we'll do it. So I'm telling you what he said then, which is, in those days, he weren't politically correct. Please don't think he would have... I'm just telling you what he said. And
it's the language of the time.
It was the language of the time. And if you understand, and when I wrote A Good Report, I include those attitudes. And actually, when you write, if you're writing honestly, you're writing the dialogue and the attitudes of those people at the time, and you're not vindicating them, you're not authenticating their point of view, but you're showing how people spoke in those days. It only takes some intelligence to know the difference. For instance, Johnny Spates' Till Death Us Do Part with Alf Garnett, this rabid nationalist, racist Alf Garnett, they won't show those shows on the BBC now, but they were of the story of a bigot. And anyway, that's just to qualify what I said. So Spike said, "We'll direct it," and I
was Spike in it.
Yes, Spike was in it.
Yeah.
So he said, "We'll direct it." So one day in January, I get a call from Vernon Miles. He says, "Where are the set designs?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you and Spike are doing the set designs, and Spike's in Australia." He said, "It's Friday. Can I have them by Monday?" So I said, "Oh, all right." So I did the set designs. So I all have to thank Spike for this. They worked perfectly, because I made them very sparse, not complicated. I wasn't able to do complicated. And then we started directing, and after a couple of days, Spike said, "I can't do both. You'll have to take over that." And so I directed it. That was great.
And were you in it as well as an actor?
No, I occasionally...
That's the only thing you didn't
do. No, the occasion, no, I didn't do that.
Can we just have a pause there, because that's a big chunk.